accession number 30108, rule 5.
John Glaze, reel 5. So you just said about the pilots would talk sometimes.
Well, the pilots were, yeah. They were as excited as the gunner, I suppose, but trying to keep the aircraft as stable as possible. And in a real-life situation, of course, they would just want their rotors above tree height or something. They'd have to ensure there's a good background which broke up our silhouette. And, you know, they had a lot to think about as well, but invariably they got excited about the missile leaving the rails and
it almost
swept along with it.
It almost changes the role, though, doesn't it? Again, as you said, from what you were as an observer to almost being controlling what that aircraft is there to do at that point.
And in an anti-tank sortie or a hell arm, it really was. It was sometimes a gazelle would lead us in, lead in maybe two scouts. And then it was the senior air gunner, really, who took control of that situation. The pilot's job was done. He was there keeping the whole platform as stable as possible so that the air gunner could get on and have his 45 seconds of glory. And to do that, you would have to coordinate with the other hell arm scout alongside, because what you couldn't afford to have is two missiles appearing in your sight and you think, Bugger, which one am I controlling, which is his? So there had to be a degree of control. I'm in charge, I'm going to take such and such a vehicle. Now this was never done for real, this was all training, and then you would allocate a target to the other guy and he would probably fire his missile 20 seconds behind yours, so that there was some separation.
On the course, did you mentioned what you did on the course, but at the end of it, were you given the opportunity to fly a live missile?
Yeah, well, you had to qualify on live missiles, and these weren't they weren't high explosive, but they were the same weight. They had pink powder in, basically, and we'd got to Otterburn Ranges. There was an old Conqueror tank, I think, full of concrete. And we'd fired that, and I think we fired 6 missiles and had to hit with 4 or 5. I think I can't remember what the qualifying figure was. But a guy from Aerospatiale was there to monitor it, because he would log the missile numbers that were being flown, whether they behaved well or badly. And these were quite old missiles in technological terms. But a rogue missile would sometimes sky off and disappear up in the clouds and land in Scotland somewhere, I suppose. A wire break and the missile would dive right and left, right and down, and just go into the deck. So things could go wrong. Some missiles fail to leave the range, the aircraft. And then there was a procedure of waiting, trying again. Didn't go, waiting, and then we would go to a specifically designated point at which the poor old Remy technicians would have to come along and get this missile off the rails, hoping that it suddenly wasn't going to go flashing off or he's about to lift it off. Anyway.
With that new role, were you then involved in tours in the UK?
Yes, and Norway. We're heavily involved in the northern flank. So our year was... the scouts didn't actually do any Northern Ireland stuff. We were heavily involved in brigade exercises within the UK, NATO exercises in Norway, but to achieve the level of flying skill in the Norwegian mountains, we would go to Saragusse, in the Pyrenees, round about October, November, for mountain flying training in San Leocadie, which is the French mountain flying school. And again, a whole new set of skills, because you're at altitude, the air's thinner, the aircraft demand more power to do the same things, wind is reacting off cliff faces, coming over the top of mountains, driving aircraft into valley floors. potentially very, very dangerous. And Saragossa was looked forward to it because it was a challenge to all. Yeah.
With the deployments to Norway, how would you get across? Would the helicopters, would you go on board?
Some would go shipborne. Before I joined B Flight, the scout flight, they used to deploy into France, around through Holland and up Denmark and dash across to Norway. But sometimes in early January, end of December, the weather was so bad it might take a fortnight to get there. And by the time I was in B Flight, all the aircraft were going on ships, basically, because they could get there in 5 days rather than be stuck in a Danish airport for a week. Not cost effective.
You also mentioned, obviously, before about the effects of snow when you're trying to land a helicopter. Any other effects of that kind of environment on helicopters?
Well, the extreme temperatures, a number of things really. When we were at Varnes, putting the aircraft in and out of hangars created condensation because it would come in from the cold into a warm hangar. And for the Remy technicians, it became problematic. Up in Bardufoss, where the aircraft lived out on the ground, and it's sometimes minus 30 at night, the aircraft somehow reacted better, albeit the next day they had to be preheated. And a great envelope was put over the airframe, and Herman Nielsen, I think, was the make, heaters, sucked in air, heated it up, and blew it all underneath his envelope so that we could raise the temperature of the metal and the lubricating oils, etc., etc. And the last burst of fresh air was put into our flying helmets so we didn't have to put cold helmets on.
The exercises, would that be mainly with the Marine Brigade?
Yeah, but often on a much larger scale. Norwegians involved every other year. The Canadians and the Americans would come and play, often Germans, Leopard tanks, I mean large-scale exercises. So our Norway deployment really started getting the guys back into the flavour of living and working in Arctic environments, deploying into field conditions, then taking the aircraft out into field conditions, because the Remy, to move things around, a nightmare. Okay, you've got the aircraft bedded down nicely into 2 foot of snow, but moving these heaters from A to B to warm the engines up, I mean, it's a whole new environment to work in outside the comfort of a hangar. And our aim in Norway was not to go and fly from a Norwegian airbase as we flew from an airbase in UK. Our aim was to fly from field locations, living in tentage, being able to survive ourselves, and make sure that the aircraft could operate for 3rd Commando Brigade.
And the potential role within a wartime situation with a Warsaw Pact, would it be that you would probably deploy to the Northern Flank?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and the Norwegians, you know, they're well prepared. They had all the mountain passes, were dynamited, ready to avalanche. And the route across from, if they had cut through Finland from the Soviet Union into Norway, was fairly confined. You know, there's steep river valleys and mountainous. That's based on the assumption, of course, that they were going to come that way and didn't decide to come straight across Sweden into Oslo and Trondheim, which I think is what I would have done if I was a Russian general, but I wasn't.
Period of that, how long were you doing that period as an air gunner prior to the Falklands, was it?
Probably I did 3 winters in Norway, 80, 81, 82, and really that's what set us up so well for the Falklands. We had literally just come back from Norway, and not just a short Norway. I think I actually went out there before the new year as advance party, and we had been in Bardufoss, way up in the Arctic Circle, and although it's a different type of cold, we were fairly confident in our equipment, our personal equipment. We were confident in the aircraft, so that on our way to the Falklands, we knew that a huge number of things could go wrong, but we could have been better prepared.
What did you know about the Falklands prior to the conflict occurring?
Only that we had Naval Party 8901 on there. And when I was on HMS Shanty, one of the guys there had been on 8901. He had said the wildlife was splendid, unbelievable terrain, totally inhospitable, always raining, always windy, and that really, I suppose, was the extent of my knowledge. I had a picture in my mind of Dartmoor in extremis, that's all.
And did you have an idea of that there was an Argentinian threat to the
island? No. Because in conversations with this guy who had been there, I think their best trip in the year that they spent down there was going up to Buenos Aires on the mail run. So I thought, oh yeah, well, Buenos Aires is their sort of run ashore. And of course, we'd been away, so if there was any build-up in this country on the local news, we weren't really aware of it in Norway.
When did you first become aware that you might be involved?
Well, I was actually due to leave the squadron. I mean, the day that I found out we were going, I ran into work to sign my report to go on draft. And the boss was there, and I mentioned it to him last night, actually, and he said, "Oh, morning, Sergeant Glaze. Welcome back. We're going to war." He probably ripped the report up and threw it away, and because he'd been recalled from France. So it was high of activity. And we had the guy who drove him down from the airport was a Royal Artillery guy, because we had a lot of artillerymen as well in the air squadron. He was really upset that he couldn't go to the Falklands because we didn't need drivers. There were no roads there. And Dickie wasn't allowed to come. But Dickie stowed away on one of the LSLs. And about 3 miles after we'd sailed, because a chum of mine was the flight senior in that flight. And 3 miles after we sailed, Dickie came out of the heads and gave himself up.
What was your reaction to the prospect of going to war at that time?
I don't know. It's just, here we go again. Shades of Cyprus, I suppose. We're going to deploy. And we realised it was further, but... in Cyprus, what had we done? We'd shown the flag, and this was slightly different, of course, because the Turks hadn't actually gone into the sovereign base area. But all the way down, when we listened to the news every night on the World Service, I think we still thought that a diplomatic solution would be found. And we were quite happy to go there and rattle a few sabres. But as we got closer and closer, and the weather changed after ascension, and the sea got greyer, and the cloud base fell, became more ominous.
Which ship had you loaded onto?
We went down to ascension on Fearless, and then cross-decked Tristram. We didn't have the whole flight on Tristram. So some of B flight went under Tristram, and then the night before we went ashore, we cross-decked to an RFA, and I went ashore with 4-5. So we had a couple of scouts attached to 4-5 commando for the landings.
Going down on Fearless, how crowded was the ship?
Oh, I mean, all shapes, sizes, cooks, bottle washers, regimental cap badges on our mess deck. All senior NCOs, you know, SAS signaller, Navy guys asking, could we teach them how to use their rifle as a rifle instead of a club? You know, so very little sort of military experience. All good banter, I know, but we were quite busy because we were given some weapons which could be mounted in the scouts. Some GPMG mounts which had come from the Army Air Corps Museum, I think, and so we were looking at how we might be able to employ these, test firing the weapons. Simultaneously, the guys with the Gazelles were trying to work out how they could rig some form of automatic fire weapon from the back of the Gazelle, firing out through the side, all sorts of bungee cords employed to make sure they didn't fire up through the disc or whatever. Sneb rockets were coming down to Ascension Island. So it wasn't much time for sitting back and enjoying the cruise, really. There were constant INT briefings, a lot of physical training, especially on Fearless, because we could use the ramp coming up from the well deck there. So guys were out all the time and doing PT, carrying Carl Gustavs, or a lot of weapon training.
What was your proposed role? Obviously you weren't likely to encounter, or were you likely to encounter armoured vehicles?
Because we knew they had, I think, Panhards on there. Now I'm having to think back to how good my recognition was or was not. I think they were AML 245s or something. Anyway, we knew that they had light recce vehicles, so we didn't see our role was going to be much different from what we'd been doing in Norway. Maybe Hellarm. If we weren't Hellarm, then certainly a lot of liaison stuff. We could lift 500 pounds in an underslung load, or get the seats out the back, load a load of kit in the back. Such a good airframe for taking on any number of roles. And we knew that in that type of terrain, we had a good, solid set of skids there. Decent bit of ground clearance, more so than the Gazelle. So, although the terrain was difficult, not dissimilar to Dartmoor, and with a little bit of prudence, we thought we could manage anything that could be thrown at us climatically or in terms of the geography of the place.
And at Ascension Island, did you come ashore at Ascension Island?
Yeah, we were quite lucky, actually. We did a lot of training ashore, and a lot of things got rejigged. So, they had to offload some kit to put it on other ships. It became a switch from administrative load, where everything was thrown on board, to a tactical load. And so the scouts were employed in that. And it gave us the opportunity to get off and stretch our legs.
Did you, were the aircraft air tested as well at that stage? Obviously being on board Fearless, when you got down to the Ascension Island, were they flown as...
I think we generally spread the wings and wound them up and went ashore. I mean, problems were encountered. I remember one of the Gazelles was refueled using a pressure system, and that must have messed up the little cork on the stick inside, which told you how much fuel you had in. So one of the guys took off thinking he had a certain amount of fuel. Suddenly everything went quiet, and he had to run onto the beach. Now, the difficulty of that was they didn't know how much of this volcanic sand had been sucked up into the engine. So lessons were still being learned on the way down, I suppose, in terms of how to fuel these beasts up.
When you'd left, was it all really done in quite a lot of haste, where everybody just piled on board?
Well, even as aircrew, our worlds revolved around large packs, just like an infantryman, or Bergens, and our nav bag. The chaos of loading really was in the G4 side, and although I became to accept that later on in life when I was commissioned and a quartermaster myself, I guess we didn't think much about the problems that our own QM was facing. As long as we had our maps in our nav bag and a little tin of curry powder to make the food go down easier, then that was our horizon, maybe.
And the cross-decking onto Sestrestrum, how did that go?
Well, we did that at Ascension, so it was basically, and because we'd been working at Ascension, it was just you left one ship one day and went on the other one later on. It wasn't a huge trauma. The deck crew obviously changed. We had, we went from an RN deck crew on Fearless to working with the RFA people. Didn't seem to be a problem. The people in the RFA system couldn't have been more accommodating. If they had things in their stores, such as thick sea socks, you know, seaman socks, then they gave them to us because they knew that it was going to be cold and wet and guys need socks. So if they had it, it was ours.
Was there a change in the atmosphere in the services at that stage? Because obviously you were going on to an active war footing. Do stores that you may not have seen for some time become available? Do items that you might have been wanting but you don't quite get, did things like that become available?
Well, things started appearing which we probably didn't know existed, such as the gun mounts on the Army Air Corps Museum, the Snab rockets, the... I can't think of a piece of personal equipment, but there's all sorts of stories of things arriving at Ascension Island, never to be seen again. But I think the M&AW Carter got a double issue of AR-15s or M16s, an Armalite-style weapon anyway. And, you know, that was a bonus for them. I suppose they came under urgent operational requirements and they appeared. Whereas in the normal, but that would be standard anyway, in the normal course of events, their supply chain would have to speed up under those circumstances.
And as you neared the exclusion zone, were there any precautions on board ship as you arrived, or I'm thinking of potentially of attack or something like that?
There was darkened ship, always, and I think some of the RFAs are harder to darken than a naval ship. The hardest thing for us really on a Tristram was its lack of water. Those ships can't make water in the same way that a warship can, and so shower times were cut to I can't remember 15 minutes in the morning. But it also meant because the water was cut off during the day, if you wanted to have a drink of water, there wasn't a fountain. Well, actually, we did find one fountain that was working, but we didn't tell too many people about it. But so guys tended to fill up a couple of bottles during the day so they could get a drink. So it wasn't inconvenient. Once you get into living ship's life and get into the routine, it isn't actually too onerous. Tedious, but not hard. And when we were on Felix, it was superb entertainment. It used to come through, self-generated on the CCTV every night, and generally at the expense of the wardroom, someone would come on with a quip. Well, the skipper would come on and give a briefing where we were and point to a map.
And preparations for going ashore. Can you take me through what happened?
Yeah. So we cross-decked to the RFA. Name escapes me, with 4-5 Commando, and our preparations really were no different to going on exercise in Norway, other than we had live ammunition, ball ammunition. We still had our nav bag, we still had our helmet, we still had our first line small Bergen of essential kit, with our main kit stowed away. But we didn't know what to expect. I had this vision of carnage going across the beaches of Dieppe or somewhere where there'd be bodies strewn everywhere. And it was this idea that it was going to be that scenario. Not a great night for sleeping because we were on the floor. There were no beds left. I was happy to be with 4-5 Commando, a lot of chums there. And then, of course, the dawn came up, and we were in San Carlos water. A warship was firing its guns on Fanning Head, and SBS were firing across Tracer onto about the same point. And we knew that we were there, and wanted to get off the ship as quickly as possible, because our place of safety is ashore, not on the ship. Shades of Ashanti coming back to me, and the burning boiler room.
How was that achieved? How did you get ashore?
Oh, we flew ashore, flashed up, flew ashore. 4-5 had established a foothold. As soon as we landed, we didn't have a task. We just had to get the aircraft ashore. There was no set task at that stage. And I saw a friend of mine in mortars, who was looking up at this very big hill, sitting on a very heavy, large pile of equipment, and he grumpily explained to me that this had to be taken to the top of the hill by manpower. So I had a word with my boss, and in the absence of anything to do, we flew this kit up the top of the hill, and my old mate was eternally grateful that they didn't have to carry it.
Had you been allocated somewhere to land when you got onto the beach?
Vaguely. I mean, when we got to Ajax Bay, I think we established a piece of real estate for ourselves and sort of, this will do us over here, we'll get the aircraft up into a little gully there. But we sort of laid on the edge of a spur. There was a little concrete blockhouse, so it's a standalone, which one of the guys was sweeping out. And so we didn't really have a plan of where to establish. Should we put a bivvy up? How is someone going to come along and give us some rations? No, it was very tenuous at that stage. We didn't know whether we were going to be moved on to someone else.
And you said earlier that apart from the Falklands, which where you were allocated a pilot, were you, in that period where you would stay together as a team?
On the way down, well, virtually as we left Plymouth, we established crews. Now, in the Gazelle flights, they had more aircrew than aircraft, so they could rotate crews through. We only just had, in the Scouts, had, I think we had one spare pilot and six air gunners for six aircraft. So I think we had seven pilots, six air gunners. I might be one out there on one side or the other. But we didn't have to consider rotation, so therefore we thought it prudent to work up as teams and stay as teams for as long as it lasted.
And who were you teamed up with?
I was teamed up with the flight commander, Captain Jeff Niblett.
When you'd arrived, you said you flew the mortars up for your mate in mortars. Mm. Were you then tasked with tasking, and where did your orders, how was that coming down from?
No, that, unaware of that, really. I was a bit further down the chain of that, so it would be, that would come in at flight commander level. And we had a 2IC on the ground as well, and then the jobs would permeate down to our level, if you like. So I wasn't aware at that rank and pay grade of how things happened at the higher level.
So what jobs were you involved in? What were the second, third?
One of the first jobs was a recce troop had gone out beyond the bridgehead, and they were going, and we had to take them some rations, so because they were going to be out there a couple of days. So we loaded up with the rations and flew down this valley, thinking, I wonder what's down here. Looking, because we were below the level of the hills, looking up the hills, desolate, and aware that we were suddenly in an area where we had no protection, and possibly people were observing us from up on the hills. But we went out, we dropped the rations, and went back. Next day, of course, we heard that the recce troop hadn't found the rations. We were convinced we put them in the right place. So we flew another set out. And on the way back, we saw a parachute. And attached to the parachute was an ejector seat. And then about half a mile down the valley was the tail plane of a Pucara sticking out of a crater. And we thought, well, someone shot a Pucara down here. And life had been fairly simplistic for us. Take some rations out, go back, do the job again. But things had been happening, and there was an increasing awareness that things were happening quite violently and quickly. And the guy had clearly got out of this and was away. But the wreckage was such we didn't know if another guy was still at the bottom of this crater. And we didn't waste too much time thinking about it. We grabbed the parachute and some bits and pieces as souvenirs and legged it back to brigade and said, guess what we found?